We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which we record this podcast today, the Arakwal people of the Bundjalung Nation, and pay our respects to elders past and present.
It's my turn. It was my turn 3 pregnancies ago.
There's no heartbeat yet.
There's no sperm.
I'll do anything. I just want so much to be a mother. There's a line. There's a line. And we did a transfer, 1 embryo in each surrogate. I have learnt that I am so freaking amazing. Families come together in many different ways and we need to normalise this.
Have sex and get pregnant. It's that easy, right?
Not for 1 in 6 of us. From the makers of Beyond the Bump, we, Sophie, Jade and La, bring you Behind the Bump,
a place to share stories and shed light on miscarriage, IVF, infertility and more.
So if you're trying to conceive,
or if your friend is doing IVF,
if you just love a moving story,
then Behind the Bump is the podcast for you.
Welcome to this very special episode of Behind the Bump. I'm one of your hosts, Lakshmi Wilson, along with Jade Caldwell here today. Jade, who have we got with us today?
Today we have a very special guest by the name of Dr. Timmy. Now, some of you may have already heard of Dr. Timmy. For those that don't, Dr. Timmy is an obstetrician, fertility and IVF specialist, but more importantly, he's actually Sophie's dad. He's been on a few of our episodes via Beyond the Bump, but today he sits with us for Behind the Bump.
Yep, I am so excited. I have so many questions, possibly too many, but there are never enough. When we're talking about IVF and infertility and miscarriage, we are going to get through all of it and we want to really get into it. In true Dr. Timmy fashion, we have a feeling this might be over 2 episodes, but we're going to start from the top discussing miscarriage, then we'll go into trying to conceive, fertility, infertility, and then episode 2, we have a feeling, will be more around IVF.
Welcome, Dr. Timmy. He's like the, ready for this, Timmy, the Oprah of Beyond the Bump.
Beautiful.
You're welcome.
What would I be of Behind the Bump?
Oh, the Oracle.
Oracle.
Yeah, Oracle.
Well, you're our only expert so far, so you've got a big hill to climb today with us. I have a lot of questions and everyone has sent in a lot of questions. So to start us off, Dr. Timmy, let's talk about miscarriage. I think when we hear of someone having a miscarriage, we know that, or we're told that the most common reason for a miscarriage is that it's chromosomal, as in the embryo just wasn't viable. But when we're talking about recurrent miscarriage, which is something that most of our guests have struggled with that we've had on, does the reason change, the most common reason?
No, not at all. And indeed, people who've experienced recurrent miscarriage and undergoing investigations for recurrent miscarriage, usually all of those investigations will be normal. So there wasn't, in fact, an underlying cause found. And of course, therefore, we go back to the most common cause of miscarriage, which is an abnormal chromosomal makeup, which is also referred to as aneuploidy. So most commonly, there's an extra chromosome or there could be a missing chromosome. And in aneuploidy, the only way that we are able to find out that it was an abnormal karyotype or abnormal chromosomal makeup is if there is a miscarriage and a curette is performed and the tissue from the curette is sent off to pathology and an actual chromosomal analysis is done on it. When I started in gynecology many years ago, we very rarely did that. So it wasn't really clear what proportion of miscarriages would be related to an abnormal chromosomal makeup because it simply wasn't tested for. But it's now quite routine to send tissue off and check the chromosomal analysis. And so we now realize that the majority of those are coming back as abnormal. And as much as that might sound disappointing, I find that when a person comes back to my rooms after having a miscarriage, and I have a result and I have that explanation for them, it's greatly reassuring to them because it can undo a lot of the misinformation they've been given since their miscarriage about the fact that they, you know, exercise too much or they haven't eaten the right thing or they've done something wrong. when in fact I'm able to reassure them that fundamentally this miscarriage was due to a problem with the number of chromosomes in the pregnancy, and nothing they could have done would have changed the fact that that was going to be a miscarriage.
So with what you're talking about, as in it's the same cause, when I'm thinking of a woman who's going, okay, it's the same cause, but why am I having like three in a row and most other people are more commonly just having one and then going on to have a viable pregnancy, is there a reason why they're like keep producing these embryos that have abnormalities?
Well, there's two parts to that answer. The first part, which I think we should say early because it should be remembered throughout this whole podcast, is that humans are not particularly fertile. We have one of the lowest pregnancy rates per fertile cycle of any species on the planet. And we also have a very high miscarriage rate. So in a lot of species, if they were to mate during the fertile part of the cycle, there would be virtually a 100% pregnancy rate, often with multiple offspring, whereas in humans, it's overwhelmingly predominantly one offspring. It's not very likely that pregnancy will occur, you know, possibly in a couple where there is absolutely no reason why they couldn't conceive. It's about 25% per cycle. And humans have a very high miscarriage rate, probably overall of about one in six pregnancies. So the other thing, of course, is that as you get older, the miscarriage rate goes up, and that's because the rate of abnormal karyotypes goes up. And therefore, in producing eggs that have 23 chromosomes, or sort of a split of the 46 chromosome makeup into 23 to join with a sperm that has another 23 chromosomes, the production of that set of chromosomes gets increasingly inaccurate with age. And do remember that that a lot of women currently are trying to get pregnant in their 30s or even late 30s and early 40s, which I guess biologically is not what we were designed to do either. So I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying from a biological point of view, a female is probably fertile from a very young age, and therefore the late 30s to early 40s is very much at the long end of that fertile range. And yeah, it is possible. So let's say that a 36-year-old has a one in five chance of miscarrying. Well, just on chance alone, roll of the dice alone, that's a one in 25 chance of having two miscarriages in a row, which doesn't sound like much, but I'm sure you know a lot more than 25 people trying to have a pregnancy. So if one in 25 of them can have two miscarriages in a row, that's common. And even though it's probably, you know, like one in 125 of having three in a row, 125 isn't an enormous number of people. So these unfortunate circumstances will arise just by chance quite commonly.
I was really excited about this question because it's something I've wondered for myself. Along the lines of the same thing of what we're talking about, if someone is able to fall pregnant really easily, like not worrying about what age they are, just someone who falls pregnant really easily, is there a link between that and them having more miscarriages because they're kind of changing that ratio of how many embryos potentially could be chromosomally abnormal? Do you know what I mean?
I'm sure that each individual would have their own egg quality, and that in their ovaries, there would be eggs with the potential of producing a normal chromosome makeup and eggs with the potential to produce an abnormal chromosomal makeup in an unknown ratio. But we are unable to know that, and we are unable to test for egg quality And the most accurate test we have for egg quality is actually your date of birth.
Yeah.
So I always stress really carefully the difference between quality and quantity. So while somebody may have testing to look at egg quantity, or as it's often called, egg reserve, whilst yes, your egg reserve is usually higher the younger you are, egg quantity tests do not reflect quality. The most accurate way of looking at quality is age. And as there's no way of improving egg quality, all we can do is help people to conceive, but we can't help stop them from having a miscarriage, and we can't help improving the egg quality. You see, it would be interesting to try and say what is falling pregnant easily. I mean, because somebody may have millions of eggs in their ovaries and conceive, let's say, two pregnancies very quickly, but that was just a sample size of two. You know, that same lady may not have been so lucky and taken 3 months to conceive or 6 months to conceive. There is an element of luck there, of the egg that actually ovulates being a good quality egg, because as I said before, not every egg in that person's ovary, regardless of their age, is going to be a good quality egg. And there's nothing that can help your body to pick out good quality eggs to ovulate. So to clarify that, there are a lot of circumstances where somebody might have had a very long time of trying to conceive and perhaps even had multiple cycles of IVF at which, let's say, 50 eggs were collected and embryos were made and embryos were transferred into the uterus, and that person is unsuccessful in conceiving, as unimaginably disappointing as that sounds. And then that person may go away and 1 month just conceive spontaneously without any form of intervention. Well, the simple explanation for that is that the egg that ovulated that month was just a really superb quality egg, and it met a sperm in the fallopian tube. Fertilization and early pregnancy development occurred, implantation occurred in the uterus, and that was a successful pregnancy.
Why do missed miscarriages happen, and why does your body not recognize the loss?
Well, from the body's point of view, a pregnancy is simply an implanted embryo that initially is supported by the ovary producing progesterone from the follicle that the egg came from, and that progesterone supports the pregnancy until implantation occurs and the embryo develops into a more sophisticated embryo, which has a placenta, which then produces HCG, which is then what comes up positive in a pregnancy test. From the body's point of view, while that pregnancy is producing pregnancy hormone, it's not getting any message for there to be a withdrawal bleed. So simply, some miscarriages will miscarry early, but it's not because of in any way the body rejecting the pregnancy because it's abnormal or identifying the pregnancy as abnormal. It's simply because the pregnancy doesn't continue to grow and therefore, you know, undergoes a deterioration that leads to it miscarrying. And do remember that in what we refer to as aneuploidy or an abnormal chromosomal makeup, that could be any chromosome involved. So, for example, if the pregnancy has an extra chromosome, let's say 22, that might lead to a very early miscarriage. But if it's an extra chromosome 21, that might lead to a living child with Down syndrome. The ability of the pregnancy to continue growing is often related to what specifically that abnormality is, or what specifically that extra chromosome is. So if somebody is pregnant and has an NIPT test, testing for the genetics of the pregnancy, and a lot of people would look upon that as a Down syndrome test and a gender test. The reason it so specifically looks at chromosomes 13, 18, and 21 is because they're the three chromosomal extra chromosome situations where the pregnancy can be ongoing. And an extra chromosome 13 and an extra chromosome 18 won't go on to be a healthy living baby that delivers a term, but it could well be a pregnancy that goes on far beyond the first trimester, whereas the other extra chromosomes are associated with miscarriage because that pregnancy stops growing much earlier. So just simply having an extra or a missing chromosome does, you know, contribute to the miscarriage, but it's more a matter of which chromosome that might determine how long pregnancy goes for.
You spoke before about not wanting women to carry on with these ideas that because they exercise too much or were too stressed that they cause their miscarriage. Often I've heard a lot of these things and people ask, you know, could it be that I ate gluten and I have a gluten intolerance and that's why I had a miscarriage? To your understanding, are there any of these things that have actually been proven to have a link, like anything that a woman is doing at home, like eating gluten or exercising too much or is too stressed?
Well, smoking, yes.
Yeah.
But certainly not exercise or diet or anything like that. And I must say, even stress, I think, is grossly overrated as a cause of, let's call it, miscarriage or pregnancy complications. People have successful pregnancies in the most unbelievably stressful situations, in famine-stricken countries, in situations of domestic violence, in all sorts of terrible situations. So really, one of the main reasons for having an appointment with a person, say 6 weeks after having a miscarriage, is to really try and undo some of the misinformation that they've been told and to emphasize that there's nothing that the person's done that's caused them to miscarry, and also there's nothing they could have done to prevent them from miscarrying.
Thank you for saying that. I feel like those words are so important. Oh. It's so striking how like unintelligent our body actually is when you talk about the fact that, yeah, basically you're just releasing an egg each month that your body does not have the ability to grade into deciding whether this is worth letting go of or not. Like, it's just an interesting thing that our bodies wouldn't be better at that.
Absolutely.
I had someone ask, which I think is very interesting, that for a couple who have had, say, like a range of different miscarriages, and by that I mean like maybe they've had an early loss or a couple of early losses, what some people call a chemical pregnancy, which I don't love that term, but just 5-6 week early loss, and then maybe they've had a missed miscarriage, and then maybe they've even had a second trimester loss, would that indicate to you that there's different causes for their kind of struggles to maintain a pregnancy?
I think the most likely explanation would be, as I said before, that not all chromosomal abnormalities or aneuploidy are the same, and therefore some pregnancies would have had the potential to produce a longer lasting pregnancy before miscarriage. And then we'd have to assume that in people who have a very early miscarriage, that potentially that could be something to do with implantation and then early pregnancy development. The establishment of a successful pregnancy is an incredibly complicated sequence of events. You know, fertilization occurs and a 46 chromosome cell is made, and then early development occurs with the multiple cells being produced, then the blastocyst stage, and then the embryo producing, you know, the part of the pregnancy that goes on to be the baby and the part that goes on to become the placenta and membranes, and then implantation and the almost like you'd call it invasion of the placenta into the wall of the uterus to create its own circulation. So there's a lot of steps that go into making a successful pregnancy. So I think in some, you call them chemical, sometimes they're referred to as biochemical pregnancies, perhaps those early steps have not been successful. And of course, in those circumstances, we can't test the pregnancy for its genetic makeup. So I can't give an opinion on what the chromosomal makeup would have been on that pregnancy because it simply can't be tested.
I really love how all your answers are comforting in that it's like, it's just in the hands of nature in a way, because I think on this journey and when I was on it, like it's hard not to, but you become so obsessed with like, what am I doing wrong or what should I do or what can I do? And it's just really soothing to have that surrender, for lack of a better word, to just the idea that it's not you and that eventually, and I think this is backed up by studies, right? Eventually, even a woman who's having many miscarriages is more likely to go on to have a successful pregnancy than not.
I'm sure you'll vouch for me that I wasn't given any pre-preparation for this podcast tonight. I wasn't sent any questions.
Agreed.
Or even given the heads up on what we'll be talking about. But as soon as you've mentioned miscarriage, the message I have come straight into my mind that I want to say is that even people who would fit the strictest criteria for recurrent miscarriage to go to a recurrent miscarriage clinic, for example, and if that clinic absolutely said you have to have met certain criteria to come to this clinic, even if you follow up the patients from that clinic, the likelihood that those people would go on and have a successful pregnancy and a healthy baby is extremely high. So even in cases where the situation seems at its worst, The eventual outcomes are actually very, very good. And even in people where we, and this is the minority, where a cause for a recurrent miscarriage is found, you know, there's very much hope that going forward that that person will achieve a successful pregnancy.
What is the difference in terms of care when it comes to miscarriages with the public versus the private system? Because we've just had a few people say that, you know, when they were told that they are going to have a miscarriage in the public setting, they're like, well, just go home. And then they kind of feel like they haven't been given any, you know, extra information in case that isn't the case and they need something, further done and they need to go in.
It's an interesting point because I certainly don't want to criticize the public system or overly endorse the private system, but one scenario that would lead to less information is, of course, if a patient goes and has an ultrasound and is, say, 7 weeks pregnant and has a 7-week miscarriage, then there is the option of that being treated medically, as it's called, where the patient will be given medication and then go on to pass the pregnancy as a miscarriage. And let's face it, in the entire world of, you know, 6 billion people or whatever it is, the overwhelming majority of miscarriages in this world would occur with neither surgical nor medical management. But because we're lucky enough and, you know, well, fortunate enough to live in Australia and have access to medical care, we have medical care for miscarriage. And that may be a medical management of a miscarriage, or it might be the surgical management of a miscarriage. And then even with the surgical management of a miscarriage, the pregnancy tissue may or may not be sent off for further analysis. So yes, when I talk about results and I talk about counselling patients after their miscarriage, there's a number of steps that could vary according to different situations. And I don't want to criticize public health care, but it's probably less likely that a miscarriage with no other sort of significant contributing factors, like it's somebody's first miscarriage and there was no significant delay in conceiving. Well, I think in the public setting and in a lot of private settings, it would be very unlikely that that tissue would have a carrier type or genetic analysis done on it, because really I can understand the argument that given that there's a greater than 50% chance that that will be abnormal, apart from helping to help the patient understand why the miscarriage occurred, it doesn't really make any difference, because it's not like I can turn around and say, well, your miscarriage had an abnormal genetic makeup, so next time we're going to do this, because there is no doing this next time.
Yeah.
It's just, it's helpful for counselling, but it's probably not that helpful for ongoing management. It's helpful for the management of that miscarriage.
While you're here dispelling myths, can you speak to the idea that someone might miscarry only one gender? Is that a thing?
Absolutely not. And look, I will put my hand up in advance and say that any concept of genetic incompatibility or gender incompatibility, I personally refute as being possible. So no, I know it's happened in the movies where, you know, you can't have girls or you can't have boys, or my husband and I were incompatible. There is just no such thing. And so I don't agree with HLA typing. I don't believe in genetic decoding to try and work out miscarriage. Genetics comes into conceiving, and that's what stops different species from breeding with each other, because they're genetically incompatible. In humans, we provide through the male side 23 chromosomes from the sperm, and from the female side 23 chromosomes from the egg. And that makes 46 chromosomes in a successful pregnancy, and there is no genetic incompatibility occurring there. And indeed, in the early stages of pregnancy development, there isn't a lot of genetic sharing between the pregnancy and the patient, who is like the host of the pregnancy. And do remember that every pregnancy is a mismatch genetically to the mother or host, because no pregnancy has an identical genetic makeup to the patient carrying the pregnancy. So pregnancy is in itself designed to not be stopped by genetic incompatibility, because there'd be no pregnancies. So if you put your relative's kidney in your body, you have to have immune suppressive treatment to stop you from rejecting it. But if you put a pregnancy in your uterus, which isn't the same, you don't, your body has mechanisms to stop an immune reaction to that, but you don't have to take immune suppressant drugs in order to not reject your pregnancy.
Wow. Look, this, I have to just put this in here because I feel like you've touched upon it a little bit. And I know that a lot of our guests, and myself included, have had a diagnosis, which I think is what you're talking about, where we've been told that we have a genetic match with our partner, the DQ alpha match. And the treatment for that has been to put us on immunosuppressants. I know what you're saying about how, like, the body has to protect an embryo, so it has to see it as a foreign thing, but it protects it. So why would it be any different if it's a little bit foreign and a little bit not, if it's a DQ alpha match embryo? Like, from your knowledge, and I'm not asking you to poo-poo any one or any area of fertility, but everyone that's been given this match has also been told it's controversial. Why is it kind of a thing, but not really a thing. Some believe it, some don't.
Well, look, the whole concept of immune relationship to miscarriage, it's not just a new thing. When I was working in the UK, quite literally 30 years ago, in 1994 and 1995, my boss there was doing research on the relationship between immune changes and miscarriage and using various treatments to try and improve pregnancy outcomes through that. So please don't feel that that research into the immunology of miscarriage is a new thing. It's a very old thing, probably for as long as there's been immunology. But I certainly can't endorse those sorts of investigations, because I personally, in my opinion, don't believe that they contribute to improved success rates. And in my field of work, I am exposed to a lot of treatments, in particularly in IVF, so-called adjuvant treatments or alternative investigations like immunology, like natural killer cells. And I hope that people can respect that I need to have an opinion on these things, and I have the right to have an opinion on these things, because I can't say to a patient in front of me that I'm not going to do those investigations or treatments just because it's my right to. I have to say I'm not going to do those treatments or investigations because I don't believe they work. You know, you're talking about investigations and treatments that can be expensive, that can be invasive, that can in fact be harmful. But the problem for someone like me is that having that opinion is that people will undergo treatments for these extra issues, we'll call them, and there will be a built-in pregnancy rate.
Yeah.
There's a certain number of patients will get pregnant and have a baby, and they will attribute that success to the extra treatment they had. But in fact, the only way to form an opinion on these is to take huge numbers of patients and expose some to the treatment and some of them not to the treatment, and however you may design that, and then say, was there a difference? And you have to be wary, because remember, the difference could be that the treatment people had a lower pregnancy rate, had a higher complication rate, sometimes may have had serious, you know, bad outcomes, but in that group there are still successful pregnancies who believe that it worked for them. So, you know, I think we need to throw people a bit of rope that they can, you know, I mean, doctors and treating people and people doing investigations, that they are trying to base their opinions on information and on actual scientific knowledge and not just anecdotes that, oh, I treated a patient with this particular treatment and she was successfully pregnant and had a baby. That's not the way you want to be looked after. You want to be looked after in a way that says this particular investigation and treatment has been subjected to scientific research, which will usually mean that the patient having that treatment has had it for free. They've been counseled about the fact that it is in a scientific research setting, and that all the outcomes of their treatment, including success, including complications, including side effects, including pregnancy rates, including abnormalities in babies, have all been followed up. And then it's okay for a doctor to say, okay, I'm going to use this treatment. Now, even when it reaches that stage, and it's okay to use it as a mainstream treatment, it should still be subjected to scrutiny. It should still be subjected to follow-up and making sure that there aren't complications or side effects or abnormalities or lower pregnancy rates, because, you know, certainly science has been proved wrong in the past when they've thought that something was safe or beneficial and it's turned out that it isn't. You'd be very naive not to believe that. But it's important that you don't give people false hope by sort of throwing something at them to make them feel like you're doing something.
Mm.
You know, Tim mentioned, says that alternative medicine is alternative medicine until it's proven to work, and then it's called medicine. Oh, I would say very much that for a lot of parts of fertility care, miscarriage care, things like that.
So those studies, they haven't been done, or they have been done, or we can't do them?
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is that if somebody is treating patients in their office by giving them medications in a non-research setting, there's no surveillance of that. It's all anecdotes about where they get people are successful in conceiving. I'll give you an example. There was a test that was being done a lot in IVF where a biopsy was taken from the lining of the uterus, the endometrium, prior to the embryo transfer, to then be sent overseas to be analysed to come up with the exact timing of the embryo transfer. Now, that became extremely popular in a very quick period of time because it sounds so good.
Yeah, it does.
It was very expensive and it was used quite a lot with a real lack of any evidence that it works. And now, as you'd expect, it's been shown to have absolutely no benefit.
Wow. Is that the ERA test, ERA test? Is that what it's known as?
It is. It's the so-called ERA test.
Right.
All right, let's move on to infertility and TTC. And for those that don't know, I'm sure most of you who are listening do, but it is trying to conceive. Yes, I do know something, guys. Timmy, what is the best way to prepare your body for falling pregnant? The preconception phase, what do studies show, and do they make a difference?
Yeah, well, obviously not putting off trying to get pregnant for any longer than you have to. And I understand that conceiving a pregnancy and having a baby, there are a lot of different variables that would go into the timing of that, but certainly don't put it off in a way that's going to then lead to a reduced chance of conceiving. It obviously goes without saying to have a healthy lifestyle will be beneficial to your fertility. So having a healthy weight, healthy exercise level, being healthy mentally, physically, spiritually is obviously going to help. But some of the less obvious things to say would be that, for example, if you have a medical condition, try to get it sorted out in preparation for pregnancy. So if you have, for example, high blood pressure, go and see your doctor and talk about changing over to medications that are safe to use in pregnancy. If you have diabetes, try and conceive at a time when your diabetes has been really well managed, which has been shown to improve fertility rates and also decrease the rate of babies with abnormalities. If you have epilepsy, go and talk to your neurologist or your GP about changing your medication to medication that's safe in pregnancy. So we always assume when we're asked that question, we're talking about fit, healthy people who've never seen the doctor before. A lot of people have seen a doctor before and have medical conditions that really could be well sorted out before they tried to get pregnant. Then there's other simple things like, you know, making sure your smear test is up to date, making sure that your rubella and chickenpox immunity has been confirmed. You might want to find out on those same blood tests what your blood group is, what your blood count is, what your iron level is. You might consider having some form of genetic screening So that can come in a simple form with the 3-gene testing for cystic fibrosis, spinal muscular atrophy and Fragile X. And on one of your Beyond the Bump episodes, the wonderful woman who pioneered that test becoming something available to Medicare, you know, what she's done for the community cannot possibly be fully appreciated. Like the legacy she's left out of what she's done through her own heartbreak is just immeasurable. You know. And so instead of women having to pay $400 to go and have a test to check for their carrier state, they can go and have that on Medicare and it's every bit justified.
Incredible woman.
In another way, you can test for up to 1,000 chromosomes. So if you're really wanting to pursue pre-pregnancy genetic screening, then, you know, you've got something as huge as 1,000 chromosomes. And in that case, if you have a partner, both you and your partner would be tested. So there are things you can do to get ready. And it's not just what you eat and how you exercise and how much you weigh. It can be some medical things that you could tidy up and make easier. And then, as you know, we'd always recommend people consider taking either a multivitamin or at least folate. Try not to leave any loose ends before you get pregnant. There'd be nothing more frustrating for you than to know you had an issue that could affect pregnancy, but wait until you were pregnant to do something about it.
So you've spoken a bit about age obviously being a factor. Is there a kind of number we can put to that? At what age does a woman's fertility start to decline? And then also for men, what age does it happen for them?
Well, women, if you look at graphs and statistics and look at slopes on graphs, there's no doubt that fertility starts to decline probably as early as 34 or 35. But the descent of the graph at that age is quite shallow. And therefore, you would certainly say that people have a very good chance of conceiving beyond 34 and 35. But where the graph really does start to tilt disturbingly is beyond 39 and certainly 40, where, say, a 38-year-old would still have a very good chance of conceiving, but a 45-year-old, it's almost zero. So I know
people
say, my friend had a baby at 46. Okay, that's wonderful, but the fertility rate beyond 45 is almost zero. And remember, if you're looking at that graph of the chances of conceiving going down, at the very same time, the chances of miscarrying is going up. So both of those factors are taking you away from the desired outcome, which is a successful pregnancy.
Is that why, or I don't know if this is verified, but it seems that like infertility miscarriage is all on the rise. Is that just simply because as a society we're trying to conceive later in life?
Well, definitely if the society tries to conceive later, the chances per month of conceiving will go down and the chances of miscarrying will go up. That's an absolute.
Yeah.
I think that probably these days, a lot of people test for pregnancy a lot earlier than they used to. You know, even in the course of my career, let alone in the course of history. So a lot of people will do a urine pregnancy test even before the missed period and get a faintly positive result, and then it becomes negative and then feel that is a miscarriage. And I'm not, it may well be a what you didn't like calling a biochemical pregnancy, but so perhaps we know about more very early miscarriages than we ever did before. When I say we, I mean the whole community, patients and doctors. And inevitably, if people are trying to conceive later, then people looking to help to get pregnant will go up because the pregnancy rate goes down. But it could also be said, of course, that people are wanting to have smaller families now. There's no doubt that the number of children per family is going down. Therefore, somebody may start to try and conceive later, but they might be trying to conceive at the age where previous generations were having their fourth and fifth child, and they're going to have one or two. So I think it's important to look at numbers of babies that people are having as well as the likelihood of conceiving.
And where are we at with men? Can they, are they just fertile forever, or is there a limit and an age?
Well, there's no doubt that as you get older, the chances of accumulating a medical history go up. So if I was to say to you, pregnancy is more risky in a 40-year-old than it is in a 20-year-old, well, part of that will be is that the 40-year-old has had twice as long to accumulate some sort of medical history, have a car accident, have a fractured pelvis, have diabetes, have high blood pressure, have rheumatoid arthritis, have whatever, because they've had 20 more years, which is twice as long, to be on medication or have had medical care. So as men become older, there's more and more chances there for something to have happened to them that would have affected their fertility. But it's also true to say that, you know, it's a hell of a lot more likely an 80-year-old man will conceive spontaneously than an 80-year-old woman. And yes, men's fertility does last a lot longer. It may not be as fertile, but certainly pregnancy can occur into the 60s or even 70s or beyond.
I think you already said this before, but is there a supplement like DHEA or anything like that that actually can improve egg quality, or does it not really matter because it just depends on whatever egg's being released anyway?
Yeah, look, I feel really uncomfortable saying this because sometimes the truth hurts, but, you know, let me clarify by saying, in my opinion and on the basis of the knowledge I have, you cannot improve egg quality with any form of supplement. And I've said on Beyond the Bump before, if someone tells you that the treatment they're giving you is going to improve egg quality, turn around and run as fast as you can, because it's unfair and it's untrue. Now, there is some evidence with regard to smoking, that smoking can cause DNA damage and that it does deteriorate egg quality. So, but suggesting that someone stops smoking isn't adding a treatment, it's taking something away. And in studies which have looked at DHEA, it was more about whether or not taking DHEA improved responsiveness to follicle stimulating hormone and therefore might in some IVF cycles lead to better yields of eggs or better response to fertility treatment. Unfortunately, the initial investigations were done on primates and there appeared to be encouraging results. However, when those were transferred onto humans, the results weren't successful. The other thing is that I think you need to have a healthy dose of cynicism about drugs or treatments that are being used as like anti-aging drugs and fertility drugs and libido drugs. And you know, where one thing is being seen as the sort of, you know, panacea for all ails, you know, that's a steroid hormone that I certainly wouldn't be recommending to anyone.
How common is secondary infertility and why does it happen?
Well, secondary infertility is simply somebody who's having trouble getting pregnant who's been pregnant before. Secondary just refers to a past history of pregnancy. So primary infertility is somebody who is trying to conceive who's never been pregnant before, and secondary infertility is... So I think that's really just semantics, whether or not it's primary or secondary. The investigations, the treatment would be the same. Perhaps the underlying causes might be different in terms of the categories of causes. So, for example, if a couple have had a child before and they're now presenting, experiencing a delay in conceiving a child now, well, I guess the likelihood the male in that couple has a zero sperm count is quite low because they've had a baby before. Mm. So, yes, the categories would be slightly different. But at the end of the day, the investigation of infertility revolves around eggs, sperm, and plumbing. So whether someone presents or a couple presents and they've had a pregnancy before or they haven't, or whether they're young or old, whether they've got medical conditions, really regardless even of what their history says, what I'm interested in is those three factors. Eggs, and that will include, as I said before, both quality and quantity. Sperm, again, quality and quantity. And plumbing. And by plumbing, I mean tubal disease, endometriosis, uterine problems, things that might be, you know, let's face it, the egg and the sperm have to meet. They have to fertilize. They have to make their way down the fallopian tube and into the uterus for the pregnancy to implant. So the plumbing is important. And of course, IVF is a way of bypassing that step because you're saying, we'll take the egg and we'll take some sperm and we'll make an embryo, then we'll put it in the uterus. So the fallopian tubes and the egg and sperm meeting up with each other wasn't necessary.
For couples who want to have more than one child, is there a kind of ideal spacing from a health perspective for the woman's body going through that, as in how far apart they should space their children?
Well, very much that would be related to how the sort of index pregnancy went. So if someone had a severe medical complication of pregnancy, you know, perhaps preeclampsia and a 28-week delivery, then their recovery is going to obviously be a lot longer than somebody who had a 39-week normal delivery after an uncomplicated pregnancy. So I think it's important to take into consideration how your pregnancy went and were there any complications. I tend to be a person who encourages people that they can conceive again, you know, optimistically and positively and early. I don't see this need, you know, in the third world for nutritional reasons. People, you know, having repeated pregnancy after pregnancy can cause, of course, terrible problems. But in the first world, you know, people make a great recovery from delivery. And often, particularly if they've delayed starting a family, they don't want an unnecessary delay between pregnancies. And often the most important factor is breastfeeding. Mm. You know, somebody's breastfeeding. I'm not saying that's an absolute contraceptive, but it's certainly a relative contraceptive. And that might be the main reason to delay having another baby would be the desire to continue feeding this baby for a bit longer. And of course, patients who've had IVF who have frozen embryos can often perhaps delay it a little bit longer than they may have, because even though they're getting older, their embryos aren't getting any older. And particularly in situations where that person isn't going to try and conceive again spontaneously and, you know, perhaps has blocked tubes or is just planning to go back to IVF to conceive another pregnancy, then it's lovely for them if they froze their embryos at, say, 36, and at the time they're having their next embryo transfer, they're 40, they have the chances of a 36-year-old.
As predicted, we have run out of time this week, so stay tuned. We are going to be presenting part two next week, going into all of the other topics that we haven't got to yet, more fertility stuff, more IVF stuff. Yeah, big thank you to Dr. Timmy, and we'll be back next week with more.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Behind the Bump.
If you loved today's episode, you can head to our Facebook group, Behind the Bump, where you can join in the conversation, find support, and so much more. It's linked in the show notes.
Until next week.
Bye-bye.